on radio, on YouTube, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers, this is Invest Talk. Independent thinking, shared success. Invest Talk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. Here is KPP Financial Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. This is our February 19th edition of Invest Talk, and we are here to really distill what's going on in the markets, answer your questions, and talk a lot about the main topics for today's show. We can talk about what's going on in the Middle East. It looks like tensions are ramping up there. And obviously, there's in the midst of the earnings season, we're getting new earnings announcements. We have inflation data tomorrow. So a lot going on in markets, and we're here to help with all of it. So whatever is on your mind, don't hesitate to reach out with your call. It's always 888-99-CHART. All right. And throughout this hour, I'm going to be giving you actionable data so that you become a better investor. And we'll talk about today's market performance. We'll run down the show topics. But as usual, we'll tackle this first caller question now.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Cody. I'm from New Hampshire. I just had a question about CEG, Constellation Energy. I recently purchased it on the dip, and I was just wondering what you think about it, if it's a good purchase or not. Thank you. I'll be listening.
Looking at Constellation Energy, it is kind of a mixed bag here. It's kind of a utility, but it also has a lot of alternative energy exposure as well. Now, it operates in the Mid-Atlantic, Midwest, New York, other power regions as well. But for the most part, it is a utility. And it has negative free cash flow. Don't love that. Return equity is 20%. That's good. But that goes back to it has other aspects to its business that make it a lot riskier. Okay. So if you look at its big business segments, yeah, Mid-Atlantic is 23%, other power regions 23%, Midwest 20%, and then other would be 33%. So a third of its business is fairly risky. And that's why if you look at its longer-term profitability, it kind of ebbs and flows. So I don't love that. Now, earnings are expected to be up 34% this year and then flat. Sorry, 34% for 2025 once they report earnings and then flat this year. So growth is slowing. And that is the issue, is that it's trading at a pretty high multiple. And when growth slows into a high multiple, you get a market correction. And if you go look at the utility sector as a whole, compared to Constellation Energy, the utility sector, broader sector, is outperforming. So this is drastically underperforming really over the past 2-3 months. And I don't love that. So I don't like the momentum. I don't like the valuation. And if I want to buy a utility, I'll buy a utility that's going to pay a higher dividend yield than 0.5%, that's not trading at high multiples, and doesn't have negative free cash flow. So I'm passing on Constellation Energy. I don't like that relative performance in the near term. Thanks for the call. Now, we have a lot of ground to cover over the next 45 minutes or so, and our main focus point is about trade wars and wine in the new global tariff map. And a new report reveals how recent trade policy shifts are drastically redrawing the global competitive map. So we'll analyze some of the winners and losers in various markets and what the tariff regime has meant for trade policy globally since Liberation Day, since we're coming up on the full one-year anniversary. Now, we also have other topics on the docket. One is a new study from the Journal of Financial Economics, and they looked at different investors, from institutional investors, short sellers, the firms themselves, meaning buybacks and issuance, as well as retail investors. Who are the smartest? Who made the best trades? We'll look at that. Also, we have an economy that, unfortunately, more and more is about grift, and it's about betting markets like Kalshi. And what does this mean for the broader economy over the longer term? We'll look at that. And then if we have time, the commercial real estate market. There's a lot of can kicking over the past 5 years post-COVID within that space, but that is starting to change. Banks are starting to call in those loans. So we'll talk about that and what that might mean for the sector and the broader economy. We also have voice bank calls. One is on options, the other is on Reddit. And then we have some questions that came in via the comment section over on the Invest Talk YouTube channel as well. And of course, most importantly, will be your live call. So whatever's on your mind, 888-99-CHART is how you get through and ask your question during this hour or after hours. Either one, we're going to head to a break. Please remember, you can call anytime and leave your question on the Invest Talk voice bank. But if you're listening via our live stream or maybe on AM 1220 in the Bay Area, you can call right now at 888-99-CHART. So hang on, because I plan to talk about today's market activity in the next segment.
When you tell your friends about InvestTalk and they ask you why you listen, let them know there are many reasons, and one is parallel investing from KPP Financial and InvestTalk host Justin Klein. Parallel investing means Justin invests right alongside KPP Financial clients. He makes the same trade for KPP Financial on the same day, at the same price, and the same percentages as KPP clients. There's no front running and no special treatment. In this way, Justin and KPP Financial share the same risks and the same potential for success. Parallel investing aligns the interests of Justin and KPP Financial with those of his clients. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero are ready to answer your questions about parallel investing. And you can learn more anytime at investtalk.com. The InvestTalk phone lines never close. And now, Justin Klein is here taking your calls live. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Now let's go take a look at the market today, and it was a modest down day, and really on the back of news of Blue Owl. So not a lot of people might know what Blue Owl is, but it is a private, let's call it private equity, private credit fund issuer, and it's made a deal to sell a bunch of assets, really to shore up the balance sheet, shore up these funds. And basically what it did is it took its portfolio and it sold a lot of the good stuff to some pension funds, some insurance companies, etc. But it really called into question, and also they gated their redemptions on their funds as well. And I've been talking about this for a couple of years now, 2-3 years, that this is the space where the bad lending happened. This is where the stupid misallocation of capital happened in this cycle. In the last major cycle, it was subprime mortgages and CDOs. Now it's CLOs and private credit, private equity, all of that. And Blue Owl, now they are one of the worst run of them. So it's only natural for them to be the epicenter of the problems initially. And I think this is a Bear Stearns type moment where there's more cockroaches there. This is just the beginning. Now, does that mean it's all going to fall apart tomorrow? No, definitely not. But it's going to go through a multi-year process. And I think it's pretty interesting. The industry is trying to get ETFs approved, funds approved to go into 401ks, basically make the retail investor the bag holder. But in many ways, and you see this with many of these funds, including Blue Owl and Blue Owl BDC funds, is that it's shedding light. The market is it's trading freely, whereas private equity, private credit, they just tell you what it's worth, right? When the reality is it's probably not worth that. And but the market is saying, you know what? I don't think these are worth 100 cents in the dollar. They're worth maybe 80 cents or 70 cents. And it's shining light on the bad lending. And it's in many ways going to be their demise. Because for years, they were hiding behind the wall of mark to model and basically, in some ways, making up the current value of these assets. And they may have been able to do that for an extended period of time. But that's no longer really a choice, because they need liquidity, because they need to pay out their investors. They're not having the exits that they want at the prices that they want. And so that is the issue. And this will be the epicenter of the next credit crisis in the economy. Once again, doesn't mean it has to really come to a head this year or next year. Could be a number of years on the line. But it's clear that this is where the cockroaches live. So as I keep saying for 2-3 years, if you own any of this stuff, exit as sooner rather than later. Okay. Now, what else do we have today? Philly Fed Manufacturing posted a 16.3 positive. Consensus was 4.8. So you had some nice move on the manufacturing side. The index is now at the highest level since September of last year. New orders did fall, and the shipment index fell, and the employment index dipped into negative territory. But the prices paid index declined pretty considerably from 46.9 to 38.9, the lowest reading since January of last year. So this is some indication, at least on the manufacturing side, that inflation is calming down a bit. Now, what did the market do overall? You had the NASDAQ down about 71 points, about a third of 1%. And the S&P down 19 points, about a quarter of 1%. Dow down to 49,400 roughly, and down about 0.5% on the day. So that was the market today. Let's see, what else did you have? You had gold. Gold was down 0.2% on the day, even though the miners were up. Dollar index was up 0.2% on the day. Treasuries were flat overall, and WTI crude was up 2.1%. Really on fears of an escalation in the Middle East and the fact that we are building up our military presence in the Middle East right now, what looks to be in preparation for some sort of military action. Now, maybe it's a one and done type of strike, or it's more drawn out. But either way, the oil market is starting to price in that particular risk. So that was the market for February 19th, 2026. Now, as you probably know, we receive listener questions from the comment section over on InvestTalk and the InvestTalk YouTube channel. So let's answer one of those questions right now. Jake Samuel says, hi, guys. Give me your thoughts on IMAX, a very strong brand, diverse audience demographics, and competitive against the streaming services. Their box office system signing and system installations hit records last year. 2026 guidance is even stronger. Goodbye or pass? Well, first off, the one thing I like is it's trending positive. 84 relative strength. So it's sort of $1.61 next year. It's a $37 stock. Obviously, it's had a run, so it's not cheap. But as you said, you kind of like the trends in the business. And I think more and more theaters, like you said, with streaming, you're going to need IMAX. You're going to need their systems because this is the true differentiator to going to the movies now, for the most part. You know, home theater systems have gotten so good that if you're just going to a regular movie theater, well, what's the experience upside? It's not as much. There, a lot of people have 85-inch screens, surround sound, all of that. But nobody has, you know, the full IMAX experience. So I like the trends here. I don't love the valuation. That's my biggest worry, as I don't think it's cheap. But as a momentum play, I'm fine with it. And I don't think it's overvalued, but it's certainly not cheap. Now we're heading to a break, and we thank you for helping us achieve more than 62 million downloads in our history. So with that said, give me a call with your question at 888-99-CHART.
Justin Klein is here and ready to tackle your questions.
I've heard you say multiple times that you prefer shorter duration treasury bonds. Can you explain to me why it is more advisable?
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Every investor is working to build a secure financial future. The more you learn about how the market works, the better your chances for success. InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Justin and Luke, this is Marlo from New York. Thanks for everything you do for us, a longtime listener. I'm a long-term investor, not a trader, but I've been learning about options. And what I've always done in the past, if I have a thesis around a company, buy in two or three batches over a period of time, just to kind of manage price, especially if I'm wrong. But what I've been experimenting with lately is buying options leaps that are kind of deep in the money a year out. And the way that I've been thinking about this is it's a way of kind of managing risk. So if I happen to be wrong and the stock breaks lower, yes, I've lost that premium, but usually that's a lot less than if I had bought a full position in a stock over that first year. And if I'm right, then yes, I lose the initial upside of that initial premium, but then the rest of the journey is a return for me. And again, I'm a long-term holder and investor, not a trader. So generally, I'll make a position, full position, and hold it for 2, 3, 5 years. I've never been an options trader. I've done a little bit of covered calls, but I'm just curious, like, is using leaps this way something you would advise for building a new position, but at the same time managing risk if you get the timing quite wrong, or maybe the whole investment thesis? I'll listen for your answer on the podcast, and thanks again, guys, for everything you do for us.
This is a great question. And the simple answer is yes. When buying, and this is probably what the average investor gets wrong the most if they're dabbling in options, is they see the big upside of buying short-term options and just slightly out of the money or something, and the big potential upside. And the reality is the best way to utilize options is to give yourself more time. As the caller said, he's a long-term investor, he has a thesis, and he wants to, you know, benefit the most if his thesis plays out. And you can buy the underlying, and there's nothing wrong with that. But buying a leap gives you a little more leverage. If you're right, then great. You've made a higher return. If you're wrong, well, yeah, you lose that premium, but you would have lost a good amount anyway, if you're wrong. Because that's usually what happens with these things. They don't usually just chop sideways, either go in one direction or the other. And so leaps, and for everyone else out there, leaps are long-term options. You're talking at least a year, ideally 2 years. I would love, if I'm buying a leap, I would be going out 2 years or more and reasonably out of the money, you know, 20, 30, 40% out of the money. And so that's a great use of options. Now, is that the only way you should position yourself? I would say probably not. It probably depends on the implied volatility of that underlying position, meaning how expensive are those leaps versus just buying the underlying. If the implied volatility is, you know, in the teens or in the 20s, well, that's not very high and it could make sense to buy those leaps. If you're getting a 50, 60, 70 on the implied volatility, that means those options are going to be very, very expensive. And you could be right, but you know, the premium costs just kind of outweigh those price movements. So there's a lot of factors that go into options. In many ways, it's like operating in 3D versus a 2D chart. You know, if you're looking at a chart of a stock, you have the price and then you have obviously the time period as it goes by. When you have options, you add a layer of what we call convexity, and you add a layer of more variables, time decay, implied volatility, more variables that can move, let's say, than just price and time. So I love that you're looking at options as a way to gain exposure, but don't go overboard. Don't just say, oh, I like leaps. You have to look at them in context to the best way to play that particular position. Now let's play another caller question now.
Hi, guys. I was wondering what you guys think of the stock Albertsons, symbol ACI. I've owned it for years. It hasn't done good in the last few years. I'm wondering if I should just get out of it now. Just wondering about your opinion on it. Thank you.
Looking at Albertsons, and is one of the largest grocers in the United States. And they were, I think there was a merger proposed, but due to antitrust, it was shot down. And that kind of put it into a tailspin that really hasn't recovered from. The good thing here is that it has good cash flow. The bad thing is it has a lot of debt. It has about $15 billion in long-term debt and about a $9 billion market cap. So that cash flow, while it's good, is being used to pay down debt and not to go to you, the shareholder. And that's why the dividend has just stayed static for 5+ years. Because it's trying to right-size its balance sheet. And that's why it's struggling. And so I would pass on. I would move on. I think there's much better uses of your capital in this market. The trends are obviously poor. Relative strength, it's only 23. So yeah, I would move on from Albertsons. Now, the next Invest Talk, we'll look into the story. Behavioral finance, your brain versus your portfolio. That story will be for tomorrow. But for now, I'm Justin Klein. I'm ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
There are a few things that make KPP Financial special. One of them is parallel investing. This means they invest right alongside their clients. Here's how it works. When KPP Financial makes a trade for their clients, Justin Klein makes the same trade for himself and KPP on the same day, at the same price, and same percentage. No front running, no special treatment. Learn more about parallel investing at investtalk.com.
Now, my main focus point today concerns this story, trade wars and wine. And trade policy changes can shift who wins and who loses in the global marketplace. We know that. We've seen that recently with the U.S. and the trade measures and how they played out in practice. You know, we're almost a year into this, and industries and companies have started to adjust. But what's clear is that the impact has been pretty uneven across different sectors, different countries, etc. And a good example of that, U.S. imports of South African wine are roughly 17% points more expensive relative to the other wine exporters than from the previous year. Rice, on the other hand, from Italy has become about 12 percentage points cheaper than those from other suppliers. So depending on, you know, how this all settles out, these gaps influence how products move throughout the world, not just here, because the impact or the tariff on different countries, it's different size. And so sometimes that creates a uniform shift and other times a lumpier shift in trade flows. Now, in aggregate, developed economies have actually improved their advantage. Why? Because the weaker economies have become more disadvantaged, or the developing economy, shall we say, because they're more reliant on exports. They're more reliant on a small subset of industries. And so these tariffs have a larger impact. Developed economies have seen their relative disadvantage in the global marketplace grow from 1 to 3 percentage points. And what's interesting here is the dispersion of how this impacts different sectors. For example, the tariff on iron and steel is up 37%. Now, that's had kind of a uniform impact on the market, on the steel market here in the United States. And others have had very little impact at all. For example, coffee and tea. Why? Because we don't produce coffee and tea. And so it hasn't really impacted trade flows because there's no alternative. We can't onshore. We just kind of have to deal with it. Now, what sectors have felt the biggest impact? Mainly textiles and apparel. The tariff is not the largest. It's about 17% increase, but it's about had a 9% impact on the overall industry. And it's been lumpy. Some countries have really felt the impact and others not so much. Same with minerals. Tariffs are up about 10%, but depends on the country. Depends on the raw material. Metal ores. The tariff is only 5%, but it's having a 9% dispersion, which means that there's a lot of variability to its impact. And in the car market, the United States is nearly 20% of the global imports. And so its average tariff has increased by almost 20%. And as you would imagine, there's major repercussions for that because we rely so much on imported cars. And so the moral of the story here is it's very complex. Companies are still adjusting. They're doing diversion tactics. They're maybe not exporting directly from China, but maybe to one other country. They added another little piece to it, maybe packaging, maybe, you know, another widget to the end product. And then they export it from that country. And now they're around some of the tariffs. So that's what's happened here. The impact of tariffs have been more mitigated because of this. And I think that will continue. I think most of the tariff impact on our economy is behind us. Let's go talk to Steve in Atlanta, who wants to look at QQQI.
Hello, Justin. I hope you are doing well. First of all, just I want to thank you for through the years and everything we've learned from the show. It's amazing. What I learned from the show, I should not be interested with the QQQI for two reasons. It's high expense ratio. And the second thing, I learned from the show that I should not do or deal with ETF that I don't understand it, which is I don't understand that one. So, but it sounds interesting. So I thought I would call and ask you about it. I don't know what is the put, how's the option, how does that work? I don't know. But I thought I would ask the question.
First question that I have for you before I say anything about QQQI is, what attracted you to it originally?
Really, when I looked at it, and this, my portfolio is really very simple. I have S&P and I have BND as bonds. And this is just for income. I looked at it and it looks like at this point, as of today, it's like 13.85 income. And I thought, really, I need some income in my portfolio, but that's about it.
Okay, and this is exactly what I assumed. But this is something I've been talking about for well over a year now, that all of these, this is what is called a covered call ETF. It buys the Qs, the NASDAQ 100, and then it sells out of the money calls around 3 to 5% out of the money. Now, some sell kind of at the money, some sell out of the money. This one's out of the money. Either way, it produces income from those call options. Or it produces premiums, shall we say. Now, do you call that income or not? That's debatable. That's very debatable. But what's clear is that you shouldn't think of this as consistent real income. What you're doing is you're selling upside in the Qs and you're getting a premium. Now, we run a covered call strategy, which much rather own a different mix of stocks than the Qs. And we do things like sell out of money calls, 3 to 5, maybe 10% of the money. So in many ways, this is similar on the option side to what we do, but we don't call this all income. It's total return. And that's what you want to do with all of these covered call ETFs. You absolutely 100% ignore the income. This is not the income. It's not income like Procter & Gamble pays you income. Okay. And what most people are doing is they're chasing that number. 13 sounds high. Oh, look at that high income. I need high income. The problem is that is not income. It is selling call options, and it really is to lower the overall volatility of the underlying investments, which in this case is the Qs. And that can be a good thing, but don't think of it as income. Look at the total return of the fund. And what's the Qs? What is this doing so far this year? Well, it's down about 0.68%. Now let's go take a look at what the Qs have done this year. And compare it, because that's what you want to look at. What's the difference if I just don't sell the cover calls? What would I do? Qs are down 1.39%. So it's doing a bit better than the Qs. Why? Because it's hedging on the downside. It was just doing what it's supposed to do. But last year, the Qs were up about 21%, and this was only up about 18.6%. So what you can see here is that it's doing what it's supposed to do. It is reducing the overall volatility of holding the Qs. And that's fine if that's what you're looking for. But if you're looking for income, this is not what you're looking for. Don't think you're getting 13%. What you're getting is a covered call strategy on the NASDAQ 100. That's it.
Okay.
And as you said, the expense ratio is 68 basis points, kind of high. But yeah, this is not an income fund. Even though it might say high income ETF, know what you own. And that's what this is. It is a covered call ETF. Ignore the yield that is posted on the website or wherever you see.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Let's tackle another YouTube comment question. It says, first, a suggestion I have for future wealth webinars to cover all the different options for gaining foreign exposure. I currently have ADRs, foreign OTCs, and U.S. companies that mainly do business overseas, but are there better options like international ETFs or maybe even purchase stocks on a foreign exchange? What are all the risks to consider? Liquidity, currency risks, foreign taxes, fees, lack of data. Also, what is a good percentage of weighting of foreign exposure at this time? I've always tried to have some diversity outside the U.S., and it seems like continuing to diversify is more important now than ever, but I want to make sure I do it wisely and consider all the options. I do like that idea. We are working on our next wealth webinar, so that'll probably be announced in the next few weeks. But when it comes to foreign exposure, yes, you do want a good amount of foreign exposure. And what that number is, for an aggressive investor, at least 30% right now, probably closer to 40% of the portfolio. Now, there are different ways to get foreign exposure. ADRs, these are American Depository Receipts, meaning that you gain exposure on U.S. exchanges. And there's a lot of those. And that's the easiest, simplest way to get exposure to foreign stocks. Then you can buy foreign OTC stocks that could come with a commission. So make sure you consider that. And then U.S. companies that mainly do business overseas, that's not really, I think, a good way to gain exposure, because most of those are already owned. One of the big reasons for moving money into these foreign companies is the fact that they're under-owned. And U.S. companies are over-owned. And so, yeah, there's a lot of big U.S. companies that have foreign exposure. But that's not what's happening here. It's about flows. Money flows out of the U.S. and into these foreign markets. So the first two I like. Now, there are international ETFs. You can do that. That's a good way to gain exposure to maybe companies that don't have ADRs here. So something simpler in that way. And then what are the risks to consider? Liquidity is absolutely one, especially when you're buying OTC foreign stocks. Currency risk is always a risk with any foreign investment. Now, the risk is that the dollar will go up and those foreign currencies will go down. I think right now with our fiscal situation, our political situation, the dollar is, the path of least resistance is probably lower. Foreign taxes is another good question. Yes, dividends. A lot of times it depends if we have a agreement with that country on foreign taxes. A lot of times there's foreign taxes withheld from dividends that are paid out. So I don't know if that's a risk, but it is, could be a cost if you're looking for income from those investments. Fees, there's not usually really fees. I mean, I guess you could have commissions that are paid for buying foreign equities. There's fees within ETFs or mutual funds that you might buy. And then lack of data is probably another good one. There is risk there where a lot of foreign companies, you're only getting semi-annual updates versus quarterly updates that you get with U.S. publicly listed companies. So and it's harder to just get that data. You need to subscribe to a feed like we have FactSet, so we get a lot of that data that you might not get in traditional data sources around the web. So there's definitely issues with that as well. So hopefully that gave you a broad overview of how to think about foreign investing in today's market. Now let's hit another caller question now.
Hey, Luke and Justin, Will from Philadelphia here, calling about ticker symbol IREN, IREN Limited. It is an integrated data center that's had quite a run-up the last year. And wanted to get your thoughts if this would be a good stock to possibly take a half a position in, full position. Looking forward to hearing what you guys think and love what you guys do on the show.
Looking at IREN, IREN. And this is an interesting one because it's a vertically integrated data center business powering the future of Bitcoin, AI, and beyond with renewable energy. Now, what's interesting about this is it's kind of has some exposure to Bitcoin. And there's clearly a correlation here because it has been struggling as of late. And that's a big strike against it in my mind. But a lot of those data centers that are were built for maybe Bitcoin mining are, that a lot of those capabilities are a double in the AI data center space. And so I think that's what's been helping them and allowed them to rally, turn some profit, turn profits. They have a good balance sheet. That's good. What I don't like is that they continue to issue more and more shares. The cash flow is negative. I don't love that. And it continues to power to the negative side. And now earnings are expected to go into negative territory next year as well. And I don't like that. And it's lost some, its momentum to a degree. Made a lower high recently. So I just don't like it, especially as Bitcoin is unlikely to bottom in 2026. Now, this is InvestTalk. I'm Justin Klein. We have one goal here each and every weekday is to help you achieve your own version of financial freedom. And our work continues after this final break. So get your questions in right now at 888-99-CHART.
No two portfolios are alike, and every investor has a unique set of circumstances. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Luke or Justin. This is Casey from Vacaville, California. I've been listening to you guys for about a year now, and really love your content. I'm just calling to ask about a company called Reddit, ticker symbol RDDT. I've been dollar cost averaging. They've been at $282.95 is their 52-week high, and recently they're down to 148. I have an average cost of about 160, and they just recently had a pretty significant earnings beat. Just wondering what you guys think of this stock. Thanks for your time.
All right, looking at Reddit, and it's a relatively recent IPO back in 2024, but it's pulled back from its high around 280. Over the last year, now it's at 146. So it's been cut in half roughly, but earnings are expected to continue to accelerate to 408 this year and 579 next year. And frankly, if that is the case, I think it's a buy here. One thing I like about this, you know, now it is expensive, and if it doesn't hit those numbers, it could continue to go down. So caveat there. But what I like about this is that think about all the media platforms that are out there. From Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, they're all kind of owned by some billionaires, where Reddit is kind of that last bastion of online places that, you know, it's ugly. It's not really user-friendly, but, you know, it's not controlled. And so I think long-term, there's some benefits to that. It's profitable. Free cash flow continues to go up. It has no debt. Now, I don't like that it continues to issue shares. So that if it can stop issuing shares, I would love it. But the fact it continues to issue shares makes me a bit worried. But after this drop, I think it's a reasonable price with the expected growth going forward. Now, lastly, let's talk a bit about a study. I love this study, and it's a lot of great lessons here. And it comes from the Journal of Financial Economics. And it looked at different types of traders, from institutional investors, short sellers, the firms themselves, whether they're buying back shares, they're issuing shares, and then individual retail investors. This looked at investors from 2006 to 2017. And there's some big takeaways. Firms emerge as the best traders. Why? Companies with the lowest expected returns issued the most shares, while those with the highest expected returns were most likely buying back stock. So it shows you, share issuance or buybacks is very important. Insiders know whether their company's expensive or it's cheap. So pay big attention to that. I know we do. A lot of people love focus on dividends, but we focus a lot more on buyback yield. How much of their shares are they continually buying back with their cash flow? Who came in second? Well, short sellers. They were the most second most informed group. They shorted low expected return companies, and they didn't short a lot of high expected return companies. And what's interesting is they did it with public information. Who had the worst track record? As you expected, retail investors. But there are some caveats here. Now, overall, over the long term, they bought stocks with low expected returns and they sold stocks with high expected returns. But if you're measuring on the short term basis, measured in weeks, they saw positive returns. If they bought stocks, a stock, in the short term, it actually had pretty good predictive power. The problem was, as time went on, that wore off and the stock turned over. So what it shows you is that they're good. The average retail investor are good momentum traders, but they're not good long-term investors. They buy the hot stock. They buy when it's already rallied and the future return expectations are low. Now, institutional investors kind of was a mixed bag, honestly. Hedge funds were the most interesting. They excelled at short selling once again, but their long equity positions were pretty bad. So what are the takeaways here? Be humble. Retail investors tend to underperform over any reasonable length of time, a year, 2, 3 years plus. Follow the corporate insiders. Whether they're issuing shares, that's a red flag. If they're buying back shares, that's a green flag. Short interest, high short interest does tell you something. It reflects informed analysis. And then institutions are not magic. Just because it's a big company doesn't mean that they have a leg up on other type of investors. Well, that does it. I'm Justin Klein. I remind you that about KPP Financial's parallel investing. When we make a trade for our clients, I make a trade for myself. Same time, same price, same percentage. No front running, no special treatments. We invest right alongside our clients. So we share the same risk and potential for success. And you can learn more at investtalk.com. Please tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, or over on our YouTube channel as well. And please be sure to rate and review on iTunes. Independent thinking, shared success. This is InvestTalk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.